A new medical clinic in Milwaukee seeks to provide care specifically for the LGBTQ community.
If we want to improve the health of this community, we want to provide a place where we can give people a welcoming and affirming environment and also the expertise that they need to get health care that will improve their overall health and outcomes.
I'm Mitch Tyke. We'll learn more about the Inclusion Clinic on Lake Effect Weekend, Saturday and Sunday at 3 on Milwaukee's NPR.
From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, we'll talk with the medical director of the Frederick and Medical College's Inclusion Health Clinic. It's the first clinic here to focus on the medical needs of the LGBTQ community.
Sometimes people just don't know where they can find care that they'll feel comfortable with. And sometimes they may feel comfortable, but they might maybe missing out on some of the aspects of care that they need. So I think it's a mixed picture.
Plus, we learn how the Milwaukee Pretzel Company twists out thousands of our favorite snack a day.
So machines portion it out. We have custom machines designed in Germany that roll the pretzels out. And then the wooden tables here is where the staff actually finish rolling and twisting the pretzel.
Plus, we'll have the latest edition of our storytelling series, Exfabula. Lake Effect Weekend comes your way next after this news update. Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. There are more than 100 specialties in the field of medicine. However, few providers and clinics focus their care on the LGBTQ community. LGBT community health centers operate in only 37 of the 50 states, and many of those do not offer comprehensive services. A lack of access to care or a previous negative experience can keep people from seeking medical treatment, and that can cause long-term health consequences.
A new health clinic in Milwaukee wants to change that. The Frederick and Medical College of Wisconsin Inclusion Health Clinic opened this month, and it is the first in the region to offer an outpatient program tailored to the full range of healthcare needs of the LGBTQ community.
Dr. Andrew Petrol is an associate professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin and the medical director of the Inclusion Clinic. He joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to give us more insight into the needs the Inclusion Clinic will fill in southeastern Wisconsin.
Thank you so much for having me.
So why did Frederick and the Medical College of Wisconsin take the lead on this Inclusion Health Clinic initiative?
Sure. So the LGBTQ population faces a number of health disparities, and there's a few reasons why that is. One is that oftentimes people in this community may avoid healthcare settings because either they themselves or people that they know have had some bad experiences with healthcare, so they'll avoid it and they may suffer some consequences from that. And on the other hand, there are certain health conditions that are more prevalent in this population, which really need kind of preventive care or screening. And so that's another reason that if we want to improve the health of this community, we want to provide a place where we can give people a welcoming and affirming environment and also the expertise that they need to get health care that will improve their overall health and outcomes.
We'll get to the specifics of health and outcome related to the LGBT community. But first off, I'm curious, what is the current status quo for LGBTQ care in the medical field across most medical providers? Because I assume that's a big reason why some people stay away from the doctors.
Sure. I think that there's a wide variety of experiences that patients report after seeking health care. Some of them are good and some of them are not so good. There was a study that was done a few years ago by the Williams Institute, and they asked questions like, were you ever refused care that you needed, or were you treated poorly? And then they even asked a question about, were you treated physically, roughly, during a clinic visit? And, you know, kind of a shocking number of people report that almost 10% of transgender patients reported that they were treated in a physically abusive way in a healthcare setting. But in a broader sense, I think sometimes people just don't know where they can find care that they'll feel comfortable with. And sometimes they may feel comfortable, but they might maybe missing out on some of the aspects of care that they need. So I think it's a mixed picture.
I know doctors overall vow to do no harm, but I'm wondering, are there specific policies related to LGBTQ patients that are across the board, you know, different states have different legal discriminations. Right now, nothing is across the board followed by every state. So are there certain policies within the medical system that can change from provider to provider?
Sure. So I think you're right to say that there are no kind of uniform policies to protect people from different types of discrimination. One of the things that is out there to promote better policies is to seek status with a healthcare equality index, which is an index done by the HRC, Human Rights Campaign. And so Frederick and the Medical College of Wisconsin sought leadership status with that group starting in 2014. And what that status means is that we had to ensure that our policies regarding our own employees, visitors to the hospital or facilities, as well as our patients, have policies that cover them for non-discrimination from our hospital and from our providers. There's also elements of the types of care that you provide that we need to have to get that status. And so we've attained that status in 2014 and have maintained it ever since each year.
So this has been a long-term goal to be a leader in this field.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So what are the primary needs of LGBTQ patients and why have they not been properly addressed by the medical field? You mentioned there's more preventative care involved.
Sure. So I mean, each person has their own kind of medical needs. And in this population, there are certain types of screening tests which may be more appropriate, or certain types of preventive measures like vaccinations or certain medications. One example would be that men who have sex with men need additional vaccines like hepatitis A and HPV vaccines, which aren't routinely given to the general population. And there are certain elements of the LGBT population which have higher rates of things like STDs and HIV. So you would want to screen that population more often for those tests.
For some patients, the consequences of avoiding care sometimes outweigh a potential bad experience they might get at the clinic. So with the clinic and the doctors, what kind of experience or training do the staff receive who will be stationed here?
Sure. So all of the healthcare providers that are part of the clinic have years and in some cases, with some of us, decades of experience providing care to the LGBTQ community. So that longstanding experience is one important aspect of it. But certainly there are people on our staff who haven't been involved in healthcare that long. And what we've done is done standardized training from national organizations. And we've also brought in trainers directly to do one-on-one sessions with our staff so that they understand some of the nuances of talking with LGBTQ patients when they come to our clinic, so that we will indeed have a very welcoming and affirming environment for our patients.
One thing that is important overall for anyone in their life is having a good primary care doctor, and then for women, having a good OBGYN. And many people will report, such as in that study, that they can't find a good OBGYN that they're comfortable with. So in addition to OB services, what other kinds of services will the clinic provide?
Sure. So, you know, we bill this as what we call comprehensive primary care, which can mean different things for different people. So we know that OBGYN care is important. So some of our primary care providers on our staff are very well versed in that type of care. But we also have an OBGYN provider in our group at the clinic. Our providers will also be able to do gender-affirming hormone therapy for transgender patients, and also to provide HIV treatment and also medication for HIV prevention, which is also called PrEP. Our clinic will also have an endocrinologist as well as a psychiatrist who will do both psychiatric medication and psychotherapy.
With so many services included in one, are there any efforts by Frater to also accept as many insurance policies as possible? Because I know a lot of these treatments, many people would have to accept the fact that either they can't do it or they have to pay out of pocket for certain things like family planning or something else.
Sure. So as far as insurance, you know, our system will take any insurance that allows people to come to us, which is most insurances. And we know that for the different variety of conditions that we'll see people for, there are lots of times some navigation that we'll have to do to help people get the care that they need. And we'll do that to the full extent that we can. And some systems have ways to maneuver through and get certain aspects of care covered. And others kind of have a permanent roadblock. And, you know, we plan to work with patients as best we can to get through those things.
What kind of effect do you hope this clinic can have, not just for the local LGBTQ community, but on other healthcare providers and services?
Sure. So we've gotten a lot of great reactions already to the announcement of the clinic. We've had a lot of healthcare providers express interest in being part of it already, including both the nursing staff and other physicians at our organization. And, you know, graduates of our medical school have gone elsewhere for their training who have heard about it and may be interested in coming back and being part of it. But I think in general, just raising awareness that this population sometimes is not treated well in healthcare settings, and demonstrating how to do it well amongst our colleagues in the rest of our system and the rest of the community, I think is good for everybody.
So you can make an announcement that'll pique people's interest, but how do you establish that trust with the patients who will be coming to your clinic to want to return?
We hope that every part of the experience is welcoming to our patients from the first time that they call to make an appointment. And from then on, of course, their experience when they get to the clinic and have their appointment. And following the appointments, it's standard for our health system and most to survey patients. But we're planning to do more extensive surveying or actual qualitative questioning of patients after their visits with us on the phone or in person if they're interested, to get their feedback. Because we want to do kind of continuous quality improvement to make sure that this clinic is absolutely a wonderful and positive experience for our patients.
In addition to the staff being of importance and the patient experience, what is the importance of involving the Medical College of Wisconsin and the students and the people who are going to be graduating out of there to pique their interest in going into a field such as this?
Absolutely. So in general, training on the subject of LGBT health is not great in medical schools overall in the U.S. and Canada. There was a survey that evaluated that a few years ago and found that in the 4 years of medical school training, that the average number of hours spent on LGBTQ health was 5 hours in the 4 years. And I think actually these days students are very interested in this topic. We've already had a number of students who've heard about the clinic, both at MCW and at other medical schools, approach us and ask if they can rotate with us and get more experience. But one of the reasons that I think that these types of clinics belong in academic medical centers is to provide the opportunity for our learners, which at MCW include medical students and pharmacy students, as well as residents training in a broad variety of specialties. And so we hope to use the clinic to provide them experience in LGBT healthcare so that they can finish their training and go on to provide excellent care to this population after they're done.
I'm curious, are there any other clinics or schools across the U.S. that you've based your model on or improved upon?
There are a relatively small number of LGBTQ-oriented clinics at academic medical centers. There are a few, and we did consult with a few people that we know doing similar things. But ours is a bit different in that we have kind of a multidisciplinary team in our clinic, which is a bit different and provides a little bit more broad care than others that we've spoken with.
Which I imagine is a greater strength compared to, say, a public health center that can serve the LGBTQ community. It won't have the same resources, obviously, as a clinic would.
Right. I mean, we have all these types of specialists at our disposal and in our institution. So we really wanted to leverage that and provide kind of the broadest level of coverage. And we think that the team we've assembled so far will provide the vast majority of healthcare needs. And we'll also plan to examine when we need to refer people to other specialists and then add those specialists to our team when it's necessary.
All right. Well, Dr. Andrew Petrel, thank you so much for coming in to talk about it today.
Great. Thank you very much.
Dr. Andrew Petrel is an associate professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin and the medical director of the Frater and Medical College Inclusion Clinic, which just opened this month. He spoke with Audrey Nowakowski, and you can find more information about the clinic and the services it offers at WUWM.com.
We'll take a quick break and then get a taste for how one local company puts a twist on its small batch manufacturing. Lake Effect Weekend continues with that right after this on Milwaukee's NPR. Welcome back to Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. German Fest runs through this weekend, carrying on the Milwaukee Lakefront Festival tradition. The Summerfest grounds will be showcasing many aspects of German culture and tradition, from polka dancing, a Dachshund Derby, and, of course, many steins of beer. But what goes better with a stein than a freshly baked pretzel?
And while Milwaukee is home of German Fest, it is also home to the Milwaukee Pretzel Company that bakes its signature snack year-round. Matt and Katie Wessel founded the booming company that produces Bavarian-style soft pretzels in a converted dairy plant on the city's north side.
Back in April, they shared the history of their company with us, but my pretzel podcast co-host Michelle Maternowski and I also got a behind-the-scenes look at how they produce as many as 10,000 pretzels in a day.
I'm Matt Wessel. I am the owner of Milwaukee Pretzel Company, a company that I own with my wife, Katie. And we have been in operation for almost 5 years, and we make authentic handmade Bavarian soft pretzels, and a lot of them.
At what point did you wake up and realize that we are going to make pretzels for a living?
Well, it wasn't a morning epiphany. It was a stumbling home from a beer garden epiphany in Germany when we were living there in 2012. I don't even know what beer garden we were walking back from, but we were eating a pretzel, probably my fifth or sixth of the day. And I looked at Katie and I said, we should totally make these back in Milwaukee. And for the last 6 months of our time out there, we actually started to create a business plan and look at to see the feasibility. We talked to a few people that were over there. And when we came back here, we didn't stop. We just started looking into it. And we never really thought it would become what it's become to this point. But yeah, the roots of it were after a lot of German Weissbier and a few pretzels, we thought it'd be a good idea.
Were you pretzel lovers before you went to Germany?
Sure. Like a lot of people that eat soft pretzels at ballparks, I fell in love with them once I was over there, though. And once I realized how good a German pretzel was, I became a huge fan. I ate a lot of pretzel carbs while I was over there. For me as a foodie, though, not really. Katie, though, almost went to culinary school. She's been cooking her family's Thanksgiving dinner since she was 12. She's always been about food. So for us to find something to do together that involved food was kind of neat for her, because she's just so intuitively smart when it comes to the science behind it.
So what made you fall in love with them?
Honestly, so the pretzels in Germany, they're in the grocery store and they're just sitting next to all of the other bread. So they're not a thing that you wait to get heated. They're just sitting there and you grab one and they cost like 20 cents for a pretzel because it's such a commodity there. And it felt like a somewhat healthy, easy to eat snack. And I think the taste of them, I've always loved bread. So I'm the kind of guy that you could give me a loaf of French bread and water every day as my food and I'd be fine with it. I love bread carbs. But something about the pretzel and the flavor profile of that deep, rich pull from rye and malt, and the way they cook it with the lye or bake it with the lye, and that tough exterior. And the best pretzel in Germany is the one you eat at 2 a.m. at a beer garden, because it was made at 8 a.m. that day. It's been sitting out for 16 hours, so it's starting to get stale. But it's still, there's so much flavor there, and that stale, like, you have to work at it a little bit more. It just, I don't know, that to me was better than the ones you would get in the morning. Our pretzels, sometimes I'll have pretzels sitting in my car for a few days, and, you know, I'll start eating the ones that are 3 days old, and we don't use preservatives. It's all natural and nothing to slow down the spoilage process. So sometimes you have to be a little careful, but those are some of the best pretzels I think we make, are those 3-4-day-old pretzels.
I'm sure your food safety person loves
yeah.
that.
Well, Katie hates it too. She's like, you just told the radio people that they should eat 4-day-old pretzels. What's wrong with you?
So how many pretzels a day do you guys make now?
Well, it depends on the size, obviously. Okay. But if we were to make, it's better to talk about, I guess, in batches. You know, we go through 25, 30, 35 batches a day, which equates to, you know, thousands of pounds of dough a day. And if we're making 5-ounce pretzels, it can be up to 10,000 pretzels in a day. Yeah. It is. People like their solid carbs to go with their liquid carbs, for sure.
You were telling us a little about this before we got the tape rolling. You launched fairly abruptly in time for German Fest.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a fun story because I think it speaks to, you need a little bit of good timing, and you also just need a lot of dedication and passion behind it. So Katie and I, we came up with this idea, and in 2013, we were really trying to perfect the recipe, find a place that would let us make the product so that we could sell it, because you can't do that out of your kitchen.
And we had just found that, and weeks later we decided to meet with the Germanfest board to really get a sense of whether they would bring us in for 2014, you know, 12 months later. And we met with these, you know, a lot of men and women that very German, high German backgrounds, and they tasted the product and they liked it. And they called us a day later and they said, listen, we have a booth open at the festival, which was in like 2 or 3 weeks. Do you want to sell pretzels there? And we had no process. We had no staff. We had a bakery that we knew we could make these in. And we said, okay. And for 2.5 weeks, our family, we convinced them with beer and pizza to come to this bakery and just make pretzels as much as we could. And at that point, it took us 2.5 weeks to make what we can do now in a couple of hours. And so we sold them. We got through Germanfest and sold out, and it kind of launched us. It brought us a few accounts that we still have today. And my family always laughs because, of course, they were working the booth with us. They were our employees. And the first hour that Germanfest opened on the first day, nobody came to our booth, and they thought, oh my gosh. Apparently they were all talking in the background, like, we feel so bad for them. They made all these pretzels, and they're going to... And then, of course, it kind of snowballed, and they thought that about the entire company. When we sent the logo out for their feedback, hey, we're starting this company, we now have learned that privately, like, talking amongst themselves, like, what are they doing? Like, who's going to buy pretzels from the...
You come back from this trip.
Yeah, like, what's wrong with
them? I know what I'm doing with my life.
As the co-host of a pretzel podcast, I feel like these are our people.
Yeah, right. You understand where we were coming from.
Totally.
It took them a year or two to kind of see, like, oh, okay, we get it.
Well, as the company starts taking off, especially, you know, when the pretzels started selling at German Fests, you're probably working too fast to even notice, but there must have been some goosebump moments, like, you know, they like us, they really like us.
Yeah, for sure. I think at a festival, so a lot of our business is wholesale, so we don't talk to the customers directly, unless you're getting an email or reading a Yelp review. So when we do festivals, it's great to see and interact with the customers. And even in that first year, you would get people with a very thick German accent who come to the German Fest, and they would buy the pretzel and they would come back and say, I just want you to know that's the best German pretzel I have had in my 40 years in America. It reminds me of when I, you know, used to live back in whatever small city in Bavaria. And that's a goosebump moment. That's a validation moment of, okay, we're not crazy. We made a product that we set out to make, which was authentic Bavarian. So, and that still happens to this day. And the best compliment we get is from somebody who has been in Germany and tried the pretzels and says, yeah, you did a good job.
Have you inspired anyone to go to Germany for the first time?
Well, so when they came and visited us when we were out there, we had a lot of family that visited us, so sure. But I think what we have done is opened the eyes to people that we know in this region that when you go to Europe, you know, you think of Spain, Italy, France, and England. Those are kind of the places that people want to go, or Greece. You don't really hear Germany as a list that people want to go to. They might go there because either Oktoberfest or it happens to be a country nearby where they're already going. We, I think, have helped elevate the very romantic, nostalgic appeal of especially Southern Germany, especially around Christmas time. When you think of, for those who celebrate Christmas or at least are aware of, you know, Christmas decorations and whatnot, a lot of how we depict Christmas is very nostalgic and very European, and it's Southern German or Western French, and that is what we remember from being over there. So whenever we know of people that are going to Europe, we force them, we say, if you don't go to Munich, if you don't go to, you know, Neuschwanstein or some part of the Romantic Road and see the castles, if you don't go to beer gardens, you're missing out on a big part of the European experience. So I think so.
I want to take a trip to Germany to see pretzels.
You'll see it the minute you step off the plane in the airport, so you won't have to go very far. But the pretzel, so part of why we've been successful in Milwaukee too is we all know it's a very Germanic city. There's beer, there's cheese, there's sausage, there's street festivals, which are huge over there. It's very blue collar working class people, and we've just been missing these pretzels. And so we've brought this item to a city that kind of was ready for it. And I think that's helped us quite a bit as well. But when you go to Germany, it'll be more than just the pretzels. I think you'll realize that it kind of all comes together. And it's just this experience that makes you, you know, we lived there for a year and we were homesick in terms of not seeing our family and friends. But there was very much a familiar feel to the environment and the people and the culture because it's a lot like what we remember in Milwaukee. And that wasn't true with France and Italy and Spain, which are great places, just, you know, very vastly different cultures than what we have here.
Had you lived in France for a year, this may well be the Milwaukee foie gras.
Yeah, right. Well, when we looked at Italy, we looked at England, it didn't have to be Germany, so it's sort of fortuitous and maybe divine intervention that we ended up where we did.
Well, I feel like we should go out and visit with Katie for a few minutes.
Sure.
My name is Katie Wessel, and I'm the owner of Milwaukee Pretzel.
Do you remember the first time you tried rolling your own pretzel?
Yes. We were at our first bakery down in South Milwaukee, and I realized very quickly what an art form pretzel rolling really, really is.
Well, right. I mean, you had been, Matt told us the whole story of going and living in Germany for a year and getting kind of attached to these pretzels. You had been making food since you were a little girl, is that right?
Yes, I started when it was either 10 or 11. We had all these people coming over for Thanksgiving and my mom got really sick. She got the flu that morning. So someone had to take over. And my dad didn't even know how to make toast in the toaster, so I kind of jumped in and I fell in love with it from that point on. Now I've been making Thanksgiving every year since then. Yes.
Well, so then you go to your first bakery and you go to roll out a pretzel. That had to be kind of a humbling experience.
Yeah, it definitely, it's one of those things where it's an art form for sure. So when you first try it, it's a little frustrating because I'm a little bit of a perfectionist, so you want to do it really well the first time. And baking especially is so specific. It has to be done in an exact specific way. It's not like cooking where you can throw in a little bit of this, a little bit of that. You really have to, and rolling pretzels the exact same way. It's very, you have to do it, you have to have the exact pressure points the right way. Otherwise, the pretzel's not going to rise in the right way. So it's really important to be very consistent with it, which is hard. So
that's the rolling part. How long did it take the two of you to settle on and perfect the recipe that turned into these pretzels?
So it took about 9 months of fiddling around. It probably would have been shorter if I didn't have a full-time job at the time and I was focusing all my time on it, but we really spent time researching different regions in Germany and how they made their pretzels and what made them unique. And we also picked different things. You know, we'd go to one region in Germany, we loved their pretzel for one certain way. Then we went to another region and we kind of married all of those regions and came up with our perfect recipe according to us.
Regions are in your pretzel that you...
We do two. We do a mix of two. And some of it is just purely shape. So one area, we really like the way that they shape the pretzel. So that kind of came into a mix. And then, you know, we really liked the flavor profile of a different region. So we kind of, but we liked the texture of another. So we tried to marry the two of them.
The thing that's really struck me in talking with both you and with Matt is that the two of you were not just like looking to create a food company. The pretzels happened first.
Yes, that's exactly right. It was, we were really making them for our home use because we missed them so much. And we tried to get pretzels from all over the place saying they were Bavarian pretzels. And it just wasn't what we remembered and what we fell in love with. So originally it was, let's do this for ourselves. And then as we were kind of tasting, eating it more, we thought, hey, maybe there's a market for this. And when we started, I'll never forget my friends and all of our friends and family looked at us like, we're absolutely nuts for starting a pretzel company. And they tell us now they'll say, they go, when you guys first started that, we thought, oh no, this is such a bad idea. And they go, now here you are successful, which is great. But you know, in the beginning, everyone was a little nervous.
There's a certain timing that when it, I mean, it seems like this is really still the beginning of the pretzel wave.
Yeah, and I don't ever see really an end to it. This is such a good product. I mean, there's so many great pretzel products that are on the market, and this is such a good pairing. It's such a great appetizer option for people. The flavor on it is so wonderful. So I think it's hit the U.S., and I don't think it's going down.
You think having the name Milwaukee on your pretzels helps it in some way outside, both here and elsewhere?
Yes, absolutely. That my husband and I had our only argument with this business was what to name it. And he said, trust me, I'm in marketing. It should be Milwaukee Pretzel. And I had some cute German name. I can't even remember what it was. And I finally said, okay, you can have it. And now looking back, it was the best decision we ever made because this is home to us. And so it really ties all of that together. It brings a piece of Germany and our home kind of full circles everything together. So
I'm excited to, so is it called twisting or rolling out or what's the lingo?
Well, so we it's rolling and twisting. So as you guys saw on our machine over here, they're bringing them out into what we call pretzel strings. And then there's a little bit of rolling that happens, and then at the end they twist it. These strings that are coming out here right now, you can see they're putting them on the table. They're just letting them rest for a minute because the dough needs just a minute or so just to kind of relax so that it's easier to roll the actual pretzel. So, and if you're good at rolling pretzels, you start on Monday.
Well, yeah, so I was going to ask,
I'm good.
Yeah, me too. So when somebody signs on, how long does it typically take them to get the...
You know, it's really interesting because there's some people that it's a day and they've got it. And some people, it's a year it takes them to really get it. But generally, the average is about a good month before they really get it. And we're very particular and picky about our sizes, so...
So when you look at a tray of pretzels, do you know your employees well enough to say, oh, that's one of Joe's pretzels, that's one of...
Oh, I know. I can tell you exactly. I mean, just in the way, like he twists in a certain way, she rolls in a certain way, she twists in a certain way, she rolls in a certain... So I know if pretzels are coming out, when I see them coming out of the oven, I'm like, oh, that was Carrie's tray, or that was Dane's tray, or... You know, so, and there's definitely competition in the bakery of who rolls the best pretzel. And of course, it's me.
This has to be the slightest bit surreal to, like, think about where you were, I don't know, 5 years ago, thinking about starting this company and then looking around at what is here today.
That's what gets me so emotional at the end of the day. Even when we were walking in here this morning, my husband, I looked at him and I said, this is incredible. That we're able to employ all of these people, that they're living, they're eating, they're, you know, experiencing life because of us, which is a really, really cool feeling. And I was so shocked with how emotional that was gonna make me and my husband as well, and just how cool and rewarding that is, so.
That's way bigger than the two of you making pretzels.
Exactly, it really is. And being a business owner, you know, there's so many struggles along the way and it's a lot of hard work. And this has been the hardest work I've ever done in my life. But what keeps me going are all of our employees, hands down. And knowing that we're giving them not only a, you know, career, but a purpose and hopefully, you know, a sense of pride as well.
Do you feel like a pretzel evangelist a bit?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I like that word. I'm gonna start using that now.
Perfectly tanned, yet elegant. Juicy and crusty, incredibly lusty. Your salty skin, yeasty sin.
Matt Wessel is the co-founder and co-owner of the Milwaukee Pretzel Company. Our interview was excerpted from an episode of the Pretzel Podcast, which WUWM distributes. You can subscribe, find other episodes, and learn everything that you ever wanted to know about pretzels at WUWM.com.
One last break, and then Lake Effect Weekend returns with the latest episode of X Fabula on 89.7 WUWM.
Nobody knows why. Fluffy and warm, the queen of pastries was born. A secret ancient German recipe, mingling ordinary baking with chemistry. World's favorite accolade snack, all hail to thee. Lautengebäck.
Three, two, one.
Welcome to X Fabula!
True personal story.
X Fabula!
Exfabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And it is time for Exfabula Radio on 89.7 WUWM. We're here every weekend as part of Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bruce Winter. Leah Delaney, the co-founder of Milwaukee's Exfabula, is here bringing stories from past story slams with a theme in mind. And today, that theme would be...
Very salacious today. It's Ooh. Family secrets.
Ooh.
Dun, dun, dun.
Everybody has those.
Yeah, they do. You know, I've come to the realization that most everyone, and I'm not speaking for everybody in our listening audience, but most everyone probably feels like their family is like the most dysfunctional family that ever existed on the planet Earth. And then you come to realize later on, like, oh, everybody shares in the dysfunction.
Yeah.
And such. So it's kind of nice to know we all share that. So today I did bring a couple of stories in regards to families withholding, as it were. Let's start out today with our first story from Sue Blostein. She told us originally at our Hidden Story Slam back in October of 2016. Here is Sue Blostein.
Okay, in early September in 1969, my sister was ready to go away to college, my oldest sister. And I was 13, coming up on 14 years old, and the whole family drove her to Ohio to school. And we got to look around the campus, and I got to look at the dorm room, and I was pretty impressed. She was getting ready to begin her independent life, and I wasn't so happy that I was gonna go back to New York and start ninth grade. But a few weeks into the semester, her letters home started coming, and she would write letters to the whole family, but she also wrote letters to me, and she would tell me about all her new experiences, about the guys she was meeting, new friends, interesting friends, music, smoking pot and hashish. And so some of these things clearly had to be hidden from our parents. And, you know, we were all coming of age during the 60s, and that's almost like a cliche now. You know, the civil rights movement, the Vietnam War, the Summer of Love, Woodstock. It was a very stimulating time. And our family had dinner together every night, and we traveled together. You know, and at that time, the standard was one TV in the house in the living room. So we all watched the same news and the same programs together. So I think you could say that as a family, you know, we did process all the things that were going on. We did talk with limits. We talked about politics and we talked about current events. Some other things that would be of interest to a teenager, like sex and drugs, no. No. My parents were kind of the original practitioners, I think, of don't ask, don't tell. And they did get their messages across about what it was, what people in our family were, what we weren't, what we did, what we didn't, but it was all in a very coded, very roundabout way. So as the topic of kids and drugs got media attention, you know, my mother or father would never just sit down and say, I'll kill you if I catch you smoking pot. Nothing like that. It'd be more like we were in the car going somewhere, and my mother would tell us about a conversation she had with a colleague, and she'd say, oh, I told them that my kids have inner resources. They don't need drugs. So I'm in the back seat. I'm like, okay. Okay, I got the message, because it's really a shameful thing not to have inner resources. It's a very bad reflection on your family. But you know, I also got the bigger message, which was, you cannot talk to us about this. And because of that, I developed a habit of being very self-reliant and kind of furtive. And that can be kind of lonely, furtive, because once we had this unspoken agreement that we wouldn't spoil my parents' feeling that our family didn't have the same challenges or the same failure as other families. That's like a code of silence. And so other things like boys and birth control, I was very furtive about it. And but meanwhile, my sister wanted to help me get initiated into this great world. So at college, she made a candle, a scented candle, embedded a lump of hashish in it, and sent it to me. And of course, I got my prize. I waited for a night my parents were out. I took a jackknife. I dug it out. But here's the anticlimax. I don't even remember when I smoked it or how. I never became a pothead because I do have inner resources. But I have to say that one thing I learned is that because I had to keep certain things hidden, I would just tell myself, I'm strong, I can handle this, I have this under control. And in truth, as my teen years progressed, there were things I handled by myself that I really probably shouldn't have. And so what I learned was hidden things, just because they're hidden, they're still there.
And that was Sue Blaustein with her story that she originally told at our Hidden Story Slam.
Yeah, always good to learn from an older sibling.
Indeed. Speaking of learning,
yeah,
Ex-Fabula has partnered up with Sculpture Milwaukee. Last weekend and this weekend, so keep this in mind, we've teamed up with them to give tours of the outdoor sculptures on Wisconsin Avenue. And so we have a couple of storytellers, Elaine Molly and Sean Mitchell, that are telling personal stories that relate to the public sculptures outside on the street. So it's a fantastic tour. I did it last weekend. It's
good
great.
Stuff, eh?
I
have stopped and read some of the little, history or the little descriptions of the piece by the artist. And that's fascinating, but having stories to go along with it.
Yeah, it's just such a great experience. Yeah. And it's such a good bang for your buck. So if you want more details about how to get tickets to that, go to exfabula.org and get your ticket, because Saturday and Sunday this weekend is your last chance.
Okay.
All right.
Gotcha.
So we're going to move on to a different spin on our theme today of family secrets. Let's listen to Rochelle Fritsch, who told this particular true personal story at our Milwaukee Monumental Slam.
When my daughter was 8 years old, I realized that history was repeating itself, and not in a good way. You see, when I was her age and I didn't know who I was or who my people were, my grandparents had died long before I was born. My daughter's case, she didn't know my parents. They died long before she was here. She had a little bit of information. And that information came from boxes, I like to think, that I keep in my head. And the boxes are full of memories, full of stories that I heard. And up until that time, I just kind of scratched the surface of the stuff that was in the box. I didn't go down too deep. So I could tell her about my mom, her grandma. And she hears those stories. And I could tell her about her great-grandmother, my grandmother, whose name was Mary Jane Godley. She knew, because I told her, that Mary Jane was not from Milwaukee. She was from Missouri. And so at this point, realizing she's not knowing really who her people were, because I didn't really know who our people were, I had to keep digging in that box and go down towards the uncomfortable stuff, see what memories I could scrape out. And so the memories I could scrape out were of conversations between my mom and her sister. And they would talk about Milwaukee at the time they were growing up. Way back then, there was a streetcar. And every Saturday, my grandmother would take my mom and her sister and the rest of the siblings on the streetcar to the library on Wisconsin Avenue. And if I think about that too long, it would make me kind of ticked off, because I'm like, this library knows more about my family than I do. The stairs have felt the footsteps of my mom when she was a child, and the walls know the sound of my grandmother's voice. But it just kind of spurred me on. So I kept thinking and kept remembering, what were those conversations? And one of the things that popped up was a conversation about some relative named French Godley. And I'd hear them talk, and it'd be loud back and forth. Geneva, you remember? Ooh, French. Ooh, girl. Those were some wild people. And when they knew I was listening, they'd start whispering. So the only thing I knew was that there was somebody named French Godley, and they were wild people. I did not know what this meant. So I went to Google. So I Googled French Godley and Missouri, and I hoped for the best. I clicked, and there were pages upon pages of results with French Godley and Missouri. And for a second, I thought to myself, is this like the library on Wisconsin Avenue? The internet knows more about who I am and where I came from than I do? And then I thought, this is great. There's got to be images. And I imagined myself in that split second clicking on the images and seeing his face and calling my daughter over and going, look, baby, look at his eyes. Those are your eyes. You see the cut of his jaw? Turn your head and you can see your face in that too. I clicked on the images with that hope, and what I found instead was this blue thumbnail, and it was curious. So I opened it, and what it was a disc. It was maybe about 3 feet across, and it was royal blue and shiny, and it had an inscription on it, and there were the names, French Godley, and underneath that, Wiley Godley. This is a relative I didn't know. Or Will Godley, I'm sorry. And then under that name was Pete Hampton. And underneath all the names, it said, killed by a mob, August 19th, 1901. And I got sick in the pit of my stomach, thinking about what these people must have been through. And then I'm thinking, well, they must have deserved it. They were wild people, right? That's what I heard. So I went back to the articles, and I found a news article from a Missouri paper that actually told the facts. And the facts were this. It's an old story. Will Godley was accused of raping and murdering a white woman. He was put in jail awaiting trial when the townspeople came to the jail and broke him out, dragged him through the city streets to the downtown hotel, and tried to force him to confess. And when he wouldn't, they hung him, and then they riddled his body with bullets. The townspeople then went to the part of town where all the black people lived, to Will Godley's uncle's house. That was French Godley. French was there with his stepson, Pete Hampton, and the crowd tried to make them come out of the house, but these men were not giving up the house. And so a firefight ensued, and the townspeople burned that house down with French and Pete in it. Then the crowd moved on to the other black neighbors and said, if you don't get out of town by 3 a.m., we can't be responsible for what happens to you. So all those black people left Pierce City, Missouri, and they went their separate ways. One of those people who left was French Godley's brother. His name was Wiley Godley. And he settled in different places around the U.S., but he found his way here. He reestablished his life, he married, and he had children. One of them was Mary Jane Godley. She had Geneva. That's my mom. And so my daughter's 16, and I don't tell her that story with shame or with whispers. Because while those are the facts of our story, that's not our whole story. The story behind that is that French Godley was president of the Colored Voters Association. Maybe that's why I find myself at the polls anytime there's a vote for dog catcher to president. And then I found out that those women, that of the men who were killed, they were black women in 1901. they sued the townspeople for their loss. I figure maybe that's why my daughter has this deep sense of justice and will stand up for people, no matter what. There's no monument to any of these folks, but I found out what I needed to know, and I know where we come from.
And that was Rochelle Fritch telling a much more serious...
Yeah, definitely. I have never taken that deep dive into family history, but you never know what you're going to find out, you know?
It's such an interesting conversation to have, like what needs to be passed down in your legacy and maybe what doesn't need, and who is the captain of that information and such. So I applaud her for being curious and having a desire to really dig in there and find out so she can pass it down to her next generation.
Now I'm curious about doing research on my own family.
Well, please keep us informed.
Or we'll keep it a secret, one or the other.
Right. So really quickly, again, Milwaukee Sculpture Ex Fabula Partnership, the sculpture tours happening again this weekend, final weekend, probably until next year. We'll see how this goes. Fantastic event. If you want to figure out how to get tickets to this or anything story related, please go to exfabula.org.
And if you want to hear today's stories again, share them with friends and family. You will find it at wuwm.com. And we'll be back with more stories next weekend.
Hooray!
Ex Fabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up the show for today. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4, and be sure to tune in to our weekday version of the show at 10.
It's all on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Stay tuned now. Weekend All Things Considered is coming up next. It's 4 o'clock.